Hello and welcome to The Next Page, the podcast of the Library and Archives dedicated to advancing the conversation on multilateralism. I'm Amy Smith, and I'm so pleased to have here with me today a diplomat, a researcher, a professor, a global expert on digital knowledge, and the founder of the Diplo Foundation, Dr. Jovan Kabalija. Welcome back to The Next Page, because you've already been our guest at least once with us.
It's great to be again at the UN Library, unique place in Geneva, where history meets presence and future.
Thank you. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today, because in this episode, we're going to take you on a little journey through history to take a look at the technological developments over time. And, you know, Diplo's mission is all about diplomacy and technology. In fact, the headline of Diplo Foundation's website is Where Diplomacy Meets Technology. And this brings a bit to digital diplomacy. So let's start with your definition. How do you define it, Jovan?
Digital diplomacy is use of technological tools, in our case, digital tools and artificial intelligence, for negotiating, representing countries, and developing global public goods, which are more or less three main functions of diplomacy. It is done through three aspects: understanding digital geopolitical context in which we operate, new players, new actors, redistribution of power is the first aspect. The second is appearance of new topics on diplomatic agenda. Diplomats today negotiate artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, data. And third aspect in this interplay between digital and diplomacy is use of new tools, whether it is social media, artificial intelligence, now virtual reality and metaverse. Therefore, those are three interplays: new geopolitical context for diplomacy, new topics on diplomatic agenda, and new tools for diplomacy.
So we're going to keep these three things in mind, because the latest publication that you put out also on your website is about the history of technology. So what motivated you to write this book now, and why is it important for us to know about the history of technology?
In research about current digital diplomacy and AI, we notice a lot of excitement, but many dilemmas and some confusion. Therefore, while I was trying to see and anticipate what will happen in the future, I had to look further back in the history. And further back in the history you look, you realize that there is strong continuity of diplomacy. Diplomacy remains in its core, more or less the same as it was centuries ago. But there is a change when it comes to tools that diplomats use. Therefore, that was the motivation of this book, to look to the very, very first diplomats, our far predecessors, and to see how they acted in this trinity of the context of their societies, what topics they discussed, if any, and what tools they were using, from the smoke signals to the carriages later on, telegraph, telephone, radio, and nowadays internet, social media, and artificial intelligence.
So let's go a little bit back in time and take a look at these things, especially around these three areas of the geopolitical environment and the topics that diplomats address and the tools that diplomats use, and see how technology has really shaped diplomacy as well. So perhaps we can start with what you see as the birth of diplomacy. When do you see this happening?
Well, obviously, I cannot identify birthday of diplomacy, exact date, or even year, or even century. But history of diplomacy could be traced for the early days of humanity and our society. Because what defines us as unique, as humans, is our social interaction. Since our far predecessor jumped from the tree in Serengeti and trying to run away from lions or whatever was a danger, they realized that by sharing ideas how to survive, they can basically survive. And that was the point where they started discussing, negotiating, creating compromise, the core of diplomacy, in order to preserve social dynamics. And this is basically a moment, probably 25, 30 centuries ago, I don't know, where diplomacy started, built around the idea of compromise, keeping the social group together, and then, later on, negotiating with other social groups.
Exactly. So as communities got bigger, and especially I think with the development of agriculture and the rise of the great civilizations, what did the emergence, especially of a tool, the writing, what did that mean for diplomacy?
Amy, thank you for this question, which is particularly important because you indicated writing as a tool, as technology, and it is technology. It is so embedded in our reality today that we don't see it as a technology, but in its core, it was invented. And interestingly enough, it was invented in the Sumerian society, one of those ancient societies in the Fertile Crescent from nowadays Egypt to Iraq, basically, the most of the civilization and agricultural society were built around big rivers, Nile, Tigris and Euphrates. I'm always having problem, which I learned the names of these rivers in my native language and then translating in English is sometimes difficult. But that's exactly where the basically writing emerged. And there is a very interesting writing discovered, archaeological finding from the Sumerian time, where you basically connect emergence of writing and emergence of diplomacy. And it goes in the following way. It's a poem of Emenkar and the Lord of Arata, written around 2750 BC in Sumerian time. And it tells the story of conflict between King Enmerkar and the king of Arata. The two kings were trying to solve the conflict by sending envoys to one another. And envoys at that time had to memorize messages and to deliver to the other side. In one exchange, Enmerkar tells a long message to his messenger who claims it is difficult for him to remember. The king then takes a reed stylus and piece of clay and writes his message, thereby inviting writing. This message is sent to opposing side to Arata. When the king of Arata receives the tablet with the message, he's thrown into confusion by the written word and surrenders to Enmerkar. A rainstorm later on sent by the gods, Inanna, ends the drought in Arata and unites the two cities in peace as trade partners. It's a lovely story about early origins of writing and diplomacy. Therefore, we can take this year as the birth moment of diplomacy, 2750 BC.
It's a beautiful story. And your publication, I think, you know, I mention writing because obviously we're at the library and archives here and the written text is so important, but you even have some photos of in your publication of some beautiful libraries from the time in these ancient civilizations. So I was also wondering, would you consider that writing is the key diplomatic technology?
It is. And if you move fast forward from the, well, almost 1,000 year to 1,780 BC in Akkadian language, during the reign of the Hammurabi, you can still find the archaeological artifacts showing diplomacy. But the most important was from the 1,350, when it's related to ancient Egypt and Tel El Amarna and the ruler Akhenaten or Amenhotep IV. He, you have the whole diplomatic archive, so-called Amarna letters. Therefore, and they are in its sense not that different from today's diplomatic notes. Therefore, you have in Aklay the whole diplomatic archive, which Akhenaten exchanged with the rulers of the Middle East about peace, about marriages. Marriages were always very important in the diplomacy at that time. When I was going through the Amarna letters, I was wondering, what are we going to leave for the next generations? Let's say it is almost 3,350 years ago when we can see about Amarna diplomacy. What would be our legacy for somebody who will come after us? If they'll come in the 3,000 years.
In the digital age?
Yeah, in the year 5,400 or whatever. That's an interesting question, which is, yeah.
It certainly is. So you've mentioned a little bit about these different great civilizations, and of course we also have the ancient Persia, China, India. How did technologies in these civilizations shape diplomacy?
From the very, very early days, the Persian relied more on military might than on diplomatic skills, but during the reign of Cyrus the Great, around 550 BC, the Persians utilized an advanced messaging system similar to ancient era internet, facilitating rapid communication across vast territories of Persia. The innovation allowed for efficient coordination of diplomatic missions that they were sending and dissemination of royal decrees and enhancing the diplomatic outreach of, or footprint of Persia on the other times. On the other hand, in the first millennium BC, the ancient China had an organized system of polite dialogues and diplomatic protocol between their many Chinese kingdom and surrounding rulers. Chinese philosophers thought the best way for a state to show influence abroad was to develop a moral society worthy of emulation by admiring foreigners and waiting confidently for them to come to China to learn. This is a quote. And it's a fascinating. It's basically public diplomacy and social media today. In the 3rd century BC, Chinese philosopher Zhuangzi advised diplomats that delivering messages faithfully is a challenging task. He emphasized that conveying messages accurately without embellishment is crucial for maintaining mutual trust between parties. Then we have, obviously, in ancient India, Katila's book Artha Shastra, one of the earliest works of Sanskrit literature, documented sophisticated diplomatic practice, including espionage, diplomatic maneuvering, and using different tools at that time to convey the message powerfully. That's just the survey that we have to be really cautious that diplomacy develops in all societies all over the world. We have many examples from Africa, from Latin America, from ancient civilization. Basically had to negotiate with their surrounding.
Worldwide. It's really fascinating. But the words diplomacy and technology both have great etymologies, diplomacy being a paper that's folded double and could be used as a travel pass or laissez-passer sort of thing. And technology also, the systematic treatment coming from the Greek word for arts and crafts and so on. So how about Greece? Tell us a little bit about ancient Greece and what the civilization meant for the development of diplomacy.
The words where diplomacy itself folded in two basically has etymological origin to ancient Greece. And as you said, ancient Greece is the cradle of modern civilization, philosophy. Whatever we write and discuss in philosophy, somebody said, is a footnote to the Plato's writings, basically, more or less. All key issues of ethics, epistemology, logic were set at that time. However, in diplomacy, ancient Greece is not considered as a golden age. Ancient Greek diplomacy was one of the most open diplomacy ever practiced, however. Envoys addressed public gatherings of citizens of the receiving state. Like today, diplomats spoke to the public. And here is one paradox that we can learn from ancient Greek. On the first glance, this openness was good, but it also created the major weakness of ancient Greek diplomacy. Facing the foreign public, envoys were advocating more than negotiating. Their task was to persuade the wide population of the receiving state not to negotiate compromise with the opposing side. Today, to a large extent, internet and social media, and unfortunately not a very favorable moment in the global history, is more this question of persuading public of the other side than sitting in places like Geneva in particular, and engaging with the opposing side and trying to reach compromise. Therefore, that's what is one of the lessons of the ancient Greek practice of diplomacy. We got so many great things from ancient Greece, but in diplomacy, it wasn't golden age.
Interesting. We've moved on a little bit to the idea of communications and also perhaps about adopting new technologies. So we've seen how important the written and spoken word is for diplomacy. And you mentioned earlier about Persia and systems for sending messages over distance were really, really vital. Tell us a little bit more about another early development in communications.
You have a wide range of practices to communicate over distance. Therefore, it is telecommunication, even in the word is telecommunicating on the distance. It's in the name of the International Telecommunication Union. And early examples are smoke signals, which I put in the title of the book, but also more sophisticated ways by using, let's say, a horse's network of the posts by Persia, which I mentioned, but also Mongolian Empire, which basically advanced very well, especially during the Genghis Khan, in communicating across the vast, vast landmass of Eurasia, which Mongolian Empire at that time controlled. Therefore, that's very, very interesting. Then there were developments later on, like hydraulic telegraph, a sort of semaphore system used during the first Punic War around 250 BC to send concealed messages between Sicily and Carthage. That was then another element of this telegraph signaling technology. And it also inspired the first signaling physical telegraph developed in France in the late 18th century through these so-called telegraph towers. Some of them exist one even today, and there is even very good wine for Châteauneuf-du-Pape, which is called Old Telegraph, which was built around one of those telegraph towers.
Really? How interesting.
And then the crucial moment was basically introduction of electrical signals and the point where the movement of message was faster than the movement of messenger. That was a crucial point. Before the introduction of telegraph, especially electric telegraph, and later telephony, delivery of message depends on the speed of the messenger sent by horses, coaches, or ships, or whatever you used. But that was a limitation. Then, for the first time, you had a faster delivery of message at the beginning of 19th century with this great invention. And that was, I would say, one of the critical moments which has not changed the nature of communication till our days, basically. Everything is becoming faster with the internet. But that moment of delinking physical movement from the message happened with the electric telegraph.
Yes. But we don't always, you know, want others to understand what the information we're relaying is about. Can you give us a couple of early examples of concealing information?
The masters of the concealing of information, the masters of diplomacy, were Romans and in particular Byzantine. Byzantine Empire, which existing almost for 10 centuries, since the end of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century till the end of the arrival of Turks, you have one of the longest living state structure in the world, in the most difficult part, in the basically nowadays Istanbul or Constantinople at that time, where everybody was attacking from the south, from the north. New nations were coming, Arab, Slavs, Central African nations, Venetian traders, we know the history. And they developed very efficient diplomacy as a way to compensate for the lack of the military power. And one of the elements in their diplomacy was the special office of barbarian affairs. Everybody beyond the walls of the Constantinople were barbarians. Therefore, they had all techniques for concealing the messages, from using the simple encryption, early encryption code, to the making special tattoos of the messenger, and then he would be shaved at the end point, and the tattoo message was on his scalp. And there were all sorts of messages that they used. Therefore, I always advise students of diplomacy to study the techniques and technologies that Byzantine Empire developed over that 10 centuries.
It really is interesting. You talk a bit about Byzantine times as being a bridge between the early and modern times. And of course, the Renaissance just after brought a rapid expansion of knowledge and change and new technology. The printing press, if we're talking about writing and dissemination of knowledge, being a remarkable example. How did the geopolitical environment and the topics addressed by diplomats and the tools used change as a result of technologies during the Renaissance?
Well, if you follow this, let's say, journey that we started from Sumerian time, nowadays Iraq, Fertile Crescent, to also Persia, to Byzantine, then things moved towards west. Mediterranean became the central sea of trading, diplomacy, unfortunately wars. And that was a shift towards Renaissance Italy. For many reasons, Renaissance Italy started flourishing. It was obviously a renewal of the ancient thinking in the culture, Petrarca and also all great thinkers of Italy, of the Renaissance Italy. But one element which facilitated diplomacy is the existence of the many powerful small states, Venice, Florence, Milan, Genoa, And they were sort of frenemies. They were friends when they had to work on the common interest, but also enemies, competitors. This term frenemies is used today a lot to describe relation, let's say, between Microsoft and Google and Meta. But it existed in ancient Italy. Therefore, they developed the first forms of diplomacy. Negotiate, not first, but elaborate forms of diplomacy. To negotiate, to represent, and the first, basically, embassy was established in the 1951 by Milan, and that was the place which was created as a physical embassy to preserve archives. And most of diplomatic history is built around archives. You had Tal Amarna in ancient Egypt, you have the first embassy in the Renaissance Italy, you have the first Ministry of Foreign Affairs by Richelieu in 17th century in France, built around archives to preserve the memory of the diplomatic service. Therefore, importance of library and the place where we are today is far-reaching. But the underlying point is, yes, diplomacy was developed in Renaissance Italy thanks to the need of negotiating these frenemies relations among the Italian city-states.
And so this cooperation then?
Yeah, cooperation, trading, making deals, protecting themselves from the foreign enemies. And obviously, the France, at that time empire, stopped the show when they invaded Italian peninsula. And then diplomacy moved from the experience of Italy, moved towards west, towards France, Central Europe, and later on across the ocean.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit more about the new technologies and how we adopt them. In the publication, you mentioned the Gartner hype cycle. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, technology has a bit of mystery. It also raises a lot of excitement, you know. It helps us to move beyond our physical limitations, electric telegraph, or even smoke signals or telephone. And it's very natural and it's encouraging. And I'm sure that all of us experience that moment of seeing the first website or using the new technology. And it's fine. The problem is that technology creates excitement and then economic, business, and other interests come and they create hype. We heard last year the hype around AI by Sam Altman and others. And there is that dynamics which was captured in the Gartner curve. Early excitement, then hype, and then disillusionment. And then something useful which remains, which is called plate of productivity. Therefore, if you analyze more or less all technologies, especially of the last 200, 300 years where we have more data from the electric telegraph, you had always that element. Early excitement, investments, disillusionment, disappointments, and then something useful remaining after that. And that's one of the fascinating findings of my research, that you don't have that different narrative between 19th century invention of electric telegraph and telephone and, let's say, today AI or few years blockchain. You know, blockchain, it was all over the place 4 or 5 years ago. Nowadays, almost, it's rarely mentioned in public spaces. Therefore, Gartner curve of hype, disillusionment, and ultimately some usefulness is such a great historical lesson.
Good thing to remember. So let's fast forward, because you've talked about more present times, telegraph, telephone, the radio and TV, and things have moved very fast in the last 100 years or so. Perhaps even a bigger leap forward, and right now is the internet and social media. You've talked a little bit about it already, but how do you think that social media has changed diplomacy?
It moved diplomacy closer to ancient Greek public diplomacy in public spaces, and less, let's say, if you use the other option, Byzantine diplomacy of compromise and negotiations. Therefore, if you find these two coordinates between public diplomacy, trying to persuade the public on the other side, or on the other side, negotiating with representatives of the other side and finding compromise, I would say the social media, generally speaking, did not have positive influence for the main function of diplomacy, of solving conflicts and crises through negotiation and compromise. That's basically, there are many shades of gray. Obviously, diplomacy is more open, it's more public, we know more what's going on. But ultimately, we are not delivering on the core function of diplomacy, which is a compromise and peaceful relations in society. And we are unfortunately seeing it coming in a very blunt way to us with all of these crises all over the world, from the Ukraine, Gaza, and you have many, many crises. Therefore, I would consider social media as a regress in the history of diplomacy.
So what do you think are the new skills and talents that diplomats do need for digital diplomacy?
They need basically to get back to basics. What is the core of their job? To engage with the other side, to represent the interests of their agent, country mainly, to try to develop emotional intelligence to understand reasoning of the other side, to negotiate in a smart way, and ultimately to reach the compromise and, what is most difficult, to deliver compromise back home. This is a real challenge. Because in our days where you have only two opinions, my and wrong, convincing your audience back home that you have to compromise is a huge, huge challenge. Building on that, they have to use new tools. They have to use social media in a specific way to support their profession, and they have to use artificial intelligence a lot. That's a real challenge. How to use AI smartly to help in their function, core function, and AI can help in this respect. I would say that's it. Back to basics, use the digital tools when they can help you in your core function, and focus more on the potentials that artificial intelligence provides for diplomatic profession as such.
Exactly. So the AI, what do you foresee in terms of diplomacy with the increasing use of AI? It has a fantastic potential to help with work of diplomats.
Like any technology, it will come with potentials and risks. On the first glance, many people are seeing the risk for profession in the UN, in the diplomacy, because AI is basically codifying and automating the core tool of diplomacy, which is language and writing. Large language models are essentially dealing with language, like OpenAI, ChatGPT. And this is the core tool of diplomacy. Now, if a large language model can generate reports from the meetings, which it can with high accuracy, or generate note verbal, or generate treaty, one can ask, okay, what will be the function of diplomats? But what we do at Diplo in particular, we are saying, yes, it's going to be a huge challenge, but you have now to raise your skills and knowledge on the next level to be ahead of AI, and it's possible. But the first point is to understand AI and to integrate in teaching processes. And after that, in the process, to be cognitively, emotionally ahead of AI. And we are doing it in practice at Diplo through so-called cognitive proximity approach. That's important. We can have this type of interviews, but what I want to show is in practice that it is possible. There's a huge challenge for inertia and traditional diplomacy, and huge opportunity to new ways of doing diplomacy with great help of AI.
Explain to us a bit more cognitive proximity. What do you mean by that?
Cognitive proximity is proximity between humans, intellectual, emotional, and ethical. Do we share the same understanding of problems of society? Do we share the same values? Do we, on emotional aspect, trust each other? One can say in Aristotelian trinity, it's linked between our brains, our heart, and our guts. And this is the core for the future organization. The more closer we are on these three layers, the more we efficient, it's not a good term, we will be in doing our job, the more we will be enjoying our job, and the more chances we will have in competition with AI. And this is another part of cognitive proximity. We have to see how we integrate tools that AI provides, how we are masters of these tools, how we engage in the augmented intelligence by using AI, but not being dominated by AI. Therefore, cognitive proximity is basically getting the best of humans working together in order to use effectively AI and still remain in charge.
I think that sounds like a wonderful place to leave this journey through the history of technology. I was just wondering if you have a final message for our listeners about technology and if there's something else you want to say about this.
Be open for excitement that technology brings. That's great. Even be open for a bit of utopia that technology brings. but be always anchored into centuries, millennia old thinking. And this interplay between diplomacy and technology synthesize that dynamics. Continuity of diplomacy, which could be traced back to our far predecessors and their need to negotiate and to reach the compromise, and change that technology introduced. Therefore, this is the message. Continuity and change with full creativity, openness, and readiness to embrace technology in a smart way, not in a naive way, not with the fear, not with the risk. And I think this is ultimate, a critical struggle that we as a humanity will have in the forthcoming years.
Thank you so much, Jovan. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more from you on AI at the Library and Archives in the coming months. And we really look forward to this conversation continuing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Emmy. It's always great to be back in this setting of the UN Library in Geneva. And I would like to invite your listeners not to miss this place, because it has a spiritus loci of that exactly wisdom of centuries, but also novelty and dynamism of new technologies. Thank you.
Thank you.